being in a job that you enjoy or don't enjoy can significantly enhance your own life, your family's life, or take years off you. And I think we forget that in the industry because we think about deals and transactions, but that, you know, fundamentally, it's a very, very human job.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm joined today by Logan Naidu. Logan is the founder and CEO of Dartmouth Partners. Over the last 8 years, they've grown from startup to one of the UK's fastest growing recruitment companies, having received private equity backing and made their first acquisition of Pure Search. Today, the group operates a multi-brand, multi-niche company with over 180 employees across five geographies. They're listed as an FT 1000 fastest growing company in Europe and are set for tremendous growth over the coming years. Logan has been named by the Sunday Times as one of Britain's 500 most influential people, and he's been shortlisted as Recruitment Entrepreneur of the Year twice. Logan, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm awesome. Thank you. Listen, when I was preparing for this, I read that you have three kids. Me too. What ages are yours?
Mine are 10, almost 8, and 5 and a half. Got to think about that carefully. Yeah,
they're fantastic.
All a good age. How are you? How old are yours?
So they are 17, 13, and 11.
You've got one that's almost out of your hands.
I know. It's gone scarily fast. Like, it just seems like yesterday, you know, she was little and now she's, you know, doing her final exams and thinking about uni and that sort of thing. So, yeah, scary stuff. Listen, I understand Dartmouth Partners is actually your second recruitment business. You founded Cornell Partnership in 2005. Why did you decide to leave that business and launch Dartmouth Partners?
Yes, good question. I set up Cornell when I was 25, 26 years old. Knew next to nothing about recruitment, and you know, sort of fell into it. And I ran around being a big biller. I had two business partners at the time, and we made decisions equally. So it was done by consensus, which actually, in hindsight, was a fundamental flaw. But ultimately, I guess as a 25-year-old, and they were probably 15 years older than me, we wanted different things in the long term. You know, I got bored of billing. You know, once you build £1 million in recruitment, which is the holy grail for a lot of people, and you've done it twice. Yeah, you know, for me, the question became, well, what happens next? And about that point, I was about 28, 29. A couple of things that happened from a private life point of view caused a lot of things to give me pause for thought. One of them was getting married. I got diagnosed with cancer on our first wedding anniversary, or the day before our first wedding anniversary. So having gone through, I guess, two life-changing things, the third one was we had a kid 6 months later after I got diagnosed. So, you know, lots of things happened by the age of 31. You know, got married, had a kid, had cancer, and I guess I was already thinking, what, you know, if I'm slightly bored at work, if I get better, what happens next? And at that point, you know, money wasn't super important to me. I just wasn't enjoying my day-to-day role. And I wanted to grow a really big company because for me, part of the journey in recruitment was how good am I at business, not how good am I just solely as a biller. You know, I think broadly there are two or three types of recruitment company. We were running a lifestyle business, you know, pull out the dividend every year, go again. And that incremental growth was stifling my own personal growth. And actually I felt most of our employees at the time as well. So that led me to probably thinking, look, I want to grow a bigger company. We can't do it at Cornell. So I'll need to go and start again.
Wow. That's an incredible journey that you've been on. So sounds like you were really successful as a biller, but you wanted to build a business and not just have a lifestyle business. You wanted to grow something. Why? What is driving that? Where does that motivation to actually build something come from?
Oh, doesn't everything come from your parents? Once parental approval? I think, if we take a step back, I think, yeah, building any company is hard. Building a people-based business is difficult and fraught yes. with ups and downs of emotion. But I think that the bit that's, you know, super interesting for me on the journey is I'm very fortunate. I get to work with a group of people, many of whom that I've worked with for a decade now. Some of them are, you know, my best friends in the world, which is super fun. But we get to grow together, right? And so the journey can often be lonely. At points, it's been very isolated and lonely. But by and large, I think I've had a good group of people around me, and we've grown on the journey together. So actually, I think seeing other people grow and flourish and helping nurture them, and in turn, you know, you grow as well. I think that's been one of the driving factors.
Awesome. Yeah, for sure. Like the personal growth here, it sounds like that is really important to you as much as the business growth. Would you share a little more about, you sort of like glossed over a huge, like dropped this bomb and then moved on, but I can't kind of get my head around still your first wedding anniversary, you're diagnosed with cancer. That must have just like, what's going through your mind at that stage, and how did that shift your perspective on business and what you wanted to do with your life?
Yeah, I'll tell you the kind of whole story. So we're Christians. We didn't live together before we got married. We got married October the 10th. We were moving house because my wife was 6 months pregnant and we needed a bigger place. And the day we were moving house was October the 9th, the year after. So the day before our first wedding anniversary. And I remember going to picking up parking tickets and getting a call. And I had a lump at the back of my leg that had grown from being the size of a kind of marble to the size of a tennis ball in the space of 3 months, just protruding at the back of my leg. So it got quite big. And no one could work out what it was, but it started to get to the point where it was quite uncomfortable. And so we moved house, and we were going to go get parking permits. And I was in the car with my father-in-law, who was a doctor. And I got a call saying, you know, we think you've got a soft tissue sarcoma. And I heard sarcoma, and I was like, sarcoma? What's a sarcoma? And my father-in-law like instantly clicked, turned the music down, and I got out of the car and let's go get these tickets. And he said, I said, I think I've got a sarcoma. And he was like, look here, I said, I don't think it's a sarcoma. So I went off. He'd already made the call to his wife, who's with my wife, saying, oh, I think he's got some bad news. When we get back, you might want to have a chat with Abby, send Abby out. So Abby got sent out onto the street, 6 months pregnant. And I had to tell her there, oh, just had a really bad call. And I think she was expecting flowers. We need to bring flowers back. So the day after our first wedding anniversary was a pretty glum affair. But fortunately, look, they caught it. They managed to cut it out, and then I had 6 months of radiotherapy, and our eldest was born, you know, three months later.
Wow.
And I think, look, during the actual, you know, operation went pretty smoothly. The radiotherapy was amazingly painful. I'll be honest, that was horrible. And I was on morphine at the end, and it was deeply unpleasant. And actually, I think, you know, my whole treatment was generally pretty straightforward. But, you know, I guess from a work point of view, what was going through my mind was, you know, keep the business afloat. And I was the driving force of the business. So I was still coming in and out of the office from the hospital. And I was still billing, because I think at that point, without my billings, the business wouldn't have survived, which is the danger with a lot of these lifestyle businesses. And you know, I think pretty clearly I was thinking that this has got to change. Whenever I come back, this whole scenario has got to change. And that was one of the driving forces. Like, you know, life is super short. I already knew that. We all know that. But from, you know, 32, I don't want this to be the rest of my working career, however long I've got, you know, just coming back, being on the billing treadmill. And so, you know, I didn't know many other recruitment businesses at the time because I hadn't worked in many. But, you know, I guess what I know now is that career path of being a billing manager, growing a team, running a division, is subsequently what drives a lot of recruitment company growth.
Yeah, absolutely. So you had this horribly unpleasant radiotherapy, and you were still going into the office and because you had to bill. That sounds insane Logan.
The stupid things we do, right?
I don't know what other options you really had, but you felt you had, this was the only way, right? So how did you actually manage that physically, psychologically? How did you get through that?
I think physically, you know, it's amazing what we can put our bodies through. So actually, you know, I put myself through, you know, quite a lot of pain. As I said, I was on morphine towards the end, and that was when I stopped working for a couple of weeks. It was just too painful. And I remember I wanted to stop taking calls. I didn't want anyone to bother me. I was, you know, sat there in my cold house feeling sorry for myself. I think the emotional side of it, you know, I think, look, you know, you go through a lot of changes, right? You've just got married. You've had a kid a year later. There's a lot of life changes, and actually emotionally, I think a lot of the biggest change for particularly a lot of men when they have their first child, you go from typically being number one in the household where, you know, the focus is, you know, rightly or wrongly, your wife kind of looks after you quite often, to being number three in the household, you know, baby, wife, then you, and you get kicked down the pecking order. And I think a lot of men struggle with that generally, don't they? I think a lot of men suddenly feel like they're not being prioritized. And actually, you know, look, my wife was incredible during the whole period and really looked after me. I think from a work point of view, I did start to resent that I was carrying the business, you know, and I started to think this can't be right. And it's not that my business partners weren't supportive. I think they were pretty supportive. I think that the reality was that the roles that we played within the business, you know, I was the driving force in the business. At that point, most of the people reported into me. And so, you know, me stepping away from the business just wasn't a physical possibility. So I think during that year, that was when it really crystallized to me, something's got to change.
Absolutely. So then from that point, when you kind of, you got to the end of your treatment and you had kind of come to this realization that you wanted something different to what the current business model was providing for you. How long did from there did you take to launch your new business?
Yeah, so I came back and I had a reasonably frank conversation. I think that the guys had known that I wanted to change things for, you know, 2 or 3 years before I was ill. You know, I'd already said that I was bored and getting a bit frustrated. You know, the challenge, as I said, was that things were done by consensus. You had two parties that wanted to run a business for a dividend. And so when I came back, I was pretty clear that, look, something needs to change. We were at a deadlock ultimately. So we have the kind of slightly tricky extrication of myself, you know, where they fundamentally bought me out. During that process, I was starting to think about what next, and what does the next business look like, and how do I not make the same mistakes? And obviously, to some extent, you make similar mistakes, so you make different ones. But we came up with this kind of pithy idea that, you know, classrooms, a boardroom model, which was the kind of the germination of an idea, or the kernel of Dartmouth, which was talent. We cover professional services in the city largely, and the idea was that talent follows money off campus, largely into Square Mile, and the cream of the crop rise to the top and do so quickly. So the idea was that rather than one individual building a brilliant black book, how do we institutionalize that as a business? And so we took a step back and said, okay, we're going to focus on early stage careers at the start. You know, 0 to 6 years was very much the focus. And then we'd grow with that candidate pool. And as they matured, our network would mature and we'd go up the food chain. And so, you know, over the last 8-9 years, we've gone from being a 0 to 6 year recruiter, going, you know, feeding up, building this great network, and then have attacked it from the top down as well, which means that we're now placing some C-suite people, CEOs, CFOs, COOs across the piece.
Wow, interesting. So what does classroom to boardroom really entail? Like, how does that work as a business model, as a methodology?
So we've got a graduate arm, which I think is within financial services is market leader. And we run soup to nuts outsourced grad recruitment for about 30 businesses. We do their marketing, their on-campus branding. We build their brand, and then we yeah, so we do the attraction piece, then we do the assessment piece. So we physically, or you know, virtually nowadays, interview about 4,000 undergrads a year.
Wow.
And we place about 10% of those into their first job. But that forms the springboard. That 4,000, we think on day one, we know roughly 70% of the best graduating talent coming into professional services in the city. And then we've tracked those people systematically through their careers. So help people get their second and third jobs. But we've just built out markets that they go into. So banking, consulting, private equity, corporate development, corporate strategy. We've now got about 14 divisions, CFO practice, change and transformation, you know, basically following the career arcs of where these high flyers go. And then we've subsequently built, I guess, a search practice that covers the more senior part of that as they progress. You know, we progress as well.
So that dynamic you've described is very British or English, and in a sense, how have you exported that model to Frankfurt, Paris, and other places?
We've done pretty much the same, actually. Okay. So, you know, you I guess in our world, a lot of people, you know, obviously chase bigger salaries because that's where the bigger fees sit. We started by saying we're going to focus on the junior end in a search esque methodology. So mapping out junior markets, getting to know the candidate pool really well. I guess a lot of the CVs look very similar at the junior end. You know, someone with 3, 4, 5 years experience, academically, they all tick similar boxes, rightly or wrongly, and then they all go and do very similar things. So the assessment piece is actually based on culture and what is that person like, and that's that's based on people hours, right? You've got to do a lot of meetings to get to know what good looks like for a specific person and an institution, and we've replicated that in Germany and Paris.
Wow, that's so cool. So you had this concept of classroom to boardroom, which seems to have really taken off, and I've not really heard of that before. So you came up with something that was quite original. How does it, you said obviously if they're all high performers academically, it comes down to culture. How do you make that assessment, you know, to make sure that they're the right person for each of your different clients, which may have different cultures?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. Every business, even if they compete head on, has a slightly different culture based on the people. So actually, you've got to get to know the firm, the hiring firm, really well and see what works for them. You know, and in some instances, we work for, as I said, market facing similar businesses, but what they look for or who they look for is actually very different. So first, you've got to get to know your client and embed yourself, you know, with the client. And that's almost acting like an internal HR function or internal recruitment function, where, you know, the key bit is not just getting great people, it's getting the right great people into the business. So there's a fair amount of time that's invested in getting to know your client in a different way to more tactical senior recruitment, where it might be a one-off mandate.
Interesting. I just noticed that you named both of your companies after Ivy League schools.
Yeah.
So
it's pretty unoriginal, isn't it?
This must be something. Well, no, I'm wondering, were you already thinking of this concept of classroom boardroom when you originated the business?
No, look, Cornell, when we came up with Cornell, it wasn't my idea, actually. I remember that was one of the other partners. Okay. But we wanted something that sounded like it had been around, sounded like it had some history.
Right.
And we didn't want our names above the door, partly because no one can pronounce my surname largely. But, you know, so we wanted something that was, you know, sounded established. And actually, when we set up, registered the Cornell name, we registered the Dartmouth name pretty much at the same time. And so, you know, it was a natural thing. When I left, the guy said, okay, you take that name. And that was part of my exit package.
All right, brilliant. So launching a new business, was it just you on your own, or did you have anyone else with you?
So I led it, but I had 8 people with me on day one. So we had a team of 8 on day one. So it was reasonably large. All bar one had worked with me at Cornell. So they'd come over with me. And that was largely the financial services team and the grad team that I'd worked with previously.
Okay. And how did you finance then this startup with eight of you?
So I'm very fortunate that my father-in-law gave me a loan, which he asked to secure against a flat I owned. So we had a secure family loan, which is, I guess, the friendliest kind of loan you can get. I remember saying to my wife, look, we could lose the house here. We got, you know, and yeah. as I said, to her credit, she didn't really care. She said, look, you know, you do what you got to do. We managed to repay that loan largely within the first 2 years.
Brilliant. Okay. And so then how did things progress from there? Like, what were the kind of key milestones that you look back on and say, wow, these were the really critical stages in the evolution of Dartmouth Partners?
I think everyone in recruitment will tell you that someone told me this the other day, but 81% of recruitment companies in the country are sub 10, right? Yes. So getting scale in the business, the first milestone is getting to break even, you know, getting consistently above break even. And that took us, we were kind of at race pace reasonably quickly on that. I think that the milestones were kind of getting past 10 people, getting past 20 people. It took us 2 years to break the bouncing around 30, which we did for a couple of years, and then going from 30 to 50. And once we got to 50, we then kicked into another gear. But that key bit was building infrastructure to support the growth, you know. And I think you can work extremely hard, run around doing effectively a billing manager's job as a director, as a CEO, up until 15, 20 people. But yeah. I would argue that you don't yet have a recruitment business that functions without you as an owner. And I think that's the change that happens. So, you know, the hardest bit is breaking 30 people, because that's when you start to need some infrastructure. You need to start to invest in that infrastructure. You're probably going to compromise some of your profit for that. The psychology for most recruitment owners who think it as cash businesses and as billers is that my profit's going to go down. You know, so is that, is that the right investment for me at this time? And we struggled with that for 12 to 18 months.
So let's talk about that. First of all, like, I believe being a billing manager is probably the toughest role in recruiting, because you're doing effectively two jobs at the same time. You are doing three jobs, because you're, you know, managing clients, making placements. You're also, you know, training, coaching, managing a team. You're also running a business. And each of those could be a full-time job effectively on its own. How did you achieve that successfully, before we go on to looking at the scaling part? Because, you know, I think this is the reason why most businesses don't grow, is it's hard. It's hard to get through that phase where, you know, you're trying to manage people and manage a desk.
Yeah, you're right. Everyone says it's the toughest job in recruitment, and it is. I actually also think it's probably the most enjoyable job in recruitment if you like managing people. And so, what makes a great biller, and we all fall into the trap of promoting great billers into being managers, and typically they're quite reluctant to do it, because it means they're going to earn less. And the psychology for most billers is that they're generally inherently selfish. You know, they're chasers. You know, so they like doing deals. If they're a good biller, they've got good pace, good focus, and it's relentless. So they're very consistent on building that pipeline. And that's one thing. You know, and one thing only. To then say, can you manage some people, which takes patience. You've got to be head up rather than head down. You've got to deal with the emotional roller coaster of looking after someone rather than just yourself. It's a very different skill set. But I think you get, if you like the latter part, you get the best of both worlds, because you're still client facing, you still get to talk to clients, you're still in the market. So you get to deliver on mandates, which is the bit that probably you enjoyed and made you successful. And then you get this new skill set, which is a whole new development area of training and nurturing people, which, if you can see beyond the first couple of years, say, well, I've got a career path in recruitment, apart from just doing the same job forever. Which actually, if you want to do that, that's great. We've got a few people like that, and they're brilliant market makers. But if you've got the ability to grow and scale a team, you've actually then got a career path beyond just doing the same job that you started out at, you know, at, let's say 2025. And so I think it's really important that people ask themselves the question when they become good billers, you know, how long do I want to do it for? And is this what I want to be doing in 10, 15, 20 years time? Because the reality is it's relentless, right? Because there's always someone younger and hungrier that's nipping at your heels, and you've got to hit refresh on your contact list and your client base every 3 to 5 years. Yeah. And as I said, some people love doing that. They're hunters by nature. Right. And so they want to do that. But I think that if you can help handhold people over that threshold in terms of understanding what it takes to be a great manager, the challenge, you know, we had was we didn't have lots of role models at the time who are great managers. And I don't think I was a great role model. I think aspirationally I wanted to do that, but I think I fell into a lot of the same pitfalls and traps of being impatient, you know, probably bad at explaining things. You know, all the classic mistakes of typically good recruiters. But fortunately we managed to train and hire people who are better at that, and they became the role models. And you know, we grew from that point.
Since you're listening to this podcast, it tells me that you're someone who's interested in personal growth and business improvement. That's something we have in common. I really enjoy listening to podcasts, reading and listening to business books, watching TED Talks. But by far the most important investment I've made in my own development has been working with a coach. It started back in 1999, 2000, when I was working as a recruiter. I hired a coach and he helped me to double my billings in 90 days. It sounds corny, but it was really a life-changing experience. Since then, I've worked with various coaches almost continuously over the years, and it's made a massive difference to my own personal and business success. In fact, that first experience of working with a coach was the catalyst for me ultimately deciding that much as I love recruitment, my true purpose was to become a coach and enable others to achieve their full potential. Fast forward to today, and I work with recruitment business owners to help them escape the feast and famine roller coaster and create consistent, predictable billings. If you'd like to know more, you can apply for a free strategy session at recruitmentcoach.com/breakthrough. I wasn't expecting to talk about this, Logan, but just I'm really intrigued to dig deeper because I think a lot of recruitment companies do get this wrong. You know, they have a top biller and that's automatically the person who becomes the manager, and they may or may not be the right character or be ready in their maturity level or whatever. How have you avoided falling into that trap, and how do you decide who those people are that are your future leaders so that you can nurture that?
So I guess there's two parts in where we are as Dartmouth. The first part was we've got a couple of people that have I've worked with for 10 plus years who were and are good billers, but again, they went through that journey of I don't want that to be my career path forever. And actually, yes, you know, intellectually they're both, or all of them are actually quite bright. And so you know, they did think conceptually around beyond money. You know, I guess what stops a lot of people thinking about that or doing it is they're captured by my income. You know, yes. And we'd always talked about a capital play as a business. You know, being honest at that point, who knew whether we were going to achieve it or not, but that was the aspiration. And then aligned to that, as you've got more role models in the business, you've got more people to point to and say, follow that person. And they're good role models, right? Because they can run a happy team, a successful team. You know, we've got five values like most companies, but the two that I really focus on are excellence and kindness. And I think you want to kind of marry the two. And you if you treat your team well, it doesn't mean having to be overtly nice to them the whole time, but sometimes you have to deliver bad messages, but in a nice way. I think you can have a happy, performing, successful team. And emotional control as a manager is super important, isn't it? That ability, not to kind of lose your rag or lose your temper with someone is super important. And so, which is hard when you're under pressure. You know, you're under pressure to deliver. But we got role models, and then the second thing, I think we put a lot of time into L&D and making sure that people were supported from beyond the just learn on the job way. And again, we go back to the investment required. That was expensive, made a lot of mistakes along the way, probably wasted a lot of money with some LND that was not not a good return or not well thought through. But I think we've now hit our stride, and we still iterate that because as we get bigger, it's a function that needs to grow. You know, as I said, we've gone from 50 to 100 people in 18 months to 2 years. And so, so that, again, the infrastructure required to train a 50 person workforce to, you know, what will be a group of 200 at the end of this year is very different.
Amazing. So I'd love to talk about those shifts with the infrastructure, the L&D. I think that's important. But first, can I just pick up on the values? Because I have never come across another, and maybe they exist out there. And if you're listening and this is one of your corporate values, then get in touch. But kindness isn't one that I've seen before in recruitment. And I love it. My mom's top number one value is kindness. And she's kind of instilled that in me. I don't always live up to it, of course, but, you know, being human, but it's definitely in my makeup, like as part of, you know, from birth, that was kind of like really important in our family. But then I've not always seen the clear path to how that applies in a business context. So what does that mean? Like, I think the thing with values, some companies just have these values, but they're words on a website, and they're not lived. So what does kindness mean in the context of a recruitment business?
Externally, with clients and candidates, you know, I always say that, you know, you might meet six people a day, but that person coming in for 1 hour to have a conversation about their career, it's super important to them, right? Because I lived through this, with my father in particular, but being in a job that you enjoy or don't enjoy can significantly enhance your own life, your family's life, or take years off you, right? So actually listening to them and taking it seriously is really important. And I think we forget that in the industry because we think about deals and transactions, but that, you know, fundamentally it's a very, very human job. And that's a real privilege. Actually, you get to know your candidates really well. A lot of them become friends over time. They really trust you. And some of my candidates that I still talk to say, "You know me better than I know me." That's a real privilege, and we shouldn't forget that. The bit internally, I think that, you know, talking to people in a, you know, and ultimately treating them in a grown up manner. Everyone says it's you know, we tend to go down the route of micromanagement and KPIs, but actually if we hire bright, good, hardworking people and train them in the right way, you can give them an awful lot of freedom. Yeah, actually you don't need to micromanage them, but with the freedom comes responsibility. So that's that Netflix culture of the two
in
go
Spider-Man's words.
Absolutely, the two come go hand in hand. And so, you know, we've hired someone that has historically achieved something, you know, whether it's sport or education or outside activity in terms of responsibilities. When you come into a recruiting business, why do we need to treat you like a child? We don't, right? We need to train you up, we need to show you how it's done, equip you with the right tools, but then the responsibilities on you. And so that takes away some of the kind of cooker pressure that exists. And then second, if we go on that basis, if things go wrong, let's have a starting point as giving each other the benefit of the doubt, right? Let's not sweat over or point the finger. And so I think, you know, look, I think it's good business sense. I think it's commercially the right thing to do. And I think that because, you know, we're generally quite good at attracting people into the industry, we're less good at keeping them. And I think if you can reduce your attrition rate generally, it's your business will kick on. So look, I think it makes the running of the business more enjoyable because you're not having a fight every day with people. I think it creates a better working environment. And I think the third thing commercially, it hits the bottom line. Broadly, I'd say it works. It doesn't mean we're not driven. You know, we're super driven by wanting to achieve, hopefully, you know, great things in the industry and beyond. And I'd say that, you know, I'm as driven as the next person. But, you know, how you're treated, no one should get out of bed looking for a fight. You know, no one wants to go home telling their, you know, household, their partner, their wife, husband, you know, what a you know, nasty conversation I have with an individual today, or how frustrating it was. You know, we do clash sometimes, right? We're human beings, and sometimes the cortisol level and the pulse rates get going. But at that point, you want to be quick to apologize and de-escalate.
Amazing. Thanks for sharing that philosophy. And the fact you've got it with it's excellence and kindness, right? So the two are not mutually exclusive by any means. So the standards for performance are still very, very high. Let's talk about L&D then, because I believe that this is the missing key to unlocking real growth that's sustainable. If you look at the difference between the sub 10, you know, companies and the growth companies, I have never come across a growth company that did not invest heavily time and money in learning development. What does that look like at Dartmouth Partners?
So I guess where we are today is very different to where we were, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, but we've got a fairly comprehensive program that goes through the career path. It takes you down two pathways now, but largely it's around creating management and leadership. You know, so we'll train you on the sales part, how to become a good biller, how to run a desk, how to be client facing, dealing with some of the trickier interactions that we have early on. And then the phase two and three and four is taking someone like that and turning them into being a good manager, which is a completely different skill set. For most people, it's not intuitive, particularly if they've come from other recruitment companies where they've not witnessed it. And we do fairly well hiring people like that who are then going on the journey of a team build. How do I assemble a team? How do I guess, have two jobs at one point, to then training people as a leader? And for that culminates with something we've got with LBS, which is a 2-year exec MBA program, which we try and put directors through, who, again, I'm thinking, you know, long term around hopefully running a much, much bigger business. How do we have proper leaders that can run divisions or much bigger areas without having to hire people in?
Amazing. So wait, you have the opportunity for people to do a 2-year executive MBA at London Business School?
Yeah, it's a collaboration with London Business School. So
okay.
It's something I called up one of the faculty, and they've you know, in conjunction, we've designed a 2-year program that's bespoke for us.
Wow. Well, that's awesome. So by the way, just so I understand, your business model, is each person a 360 degree biller, or do you have a split desk model?
No, everyone, largely the aspiration is to be a 360 biller. We're just at that tipping point, interestingly, now, where we're thinking about, is there another career path for career researchers? And we're just starting to think about that now. But the business has been built around people trying to be 360.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. And so you've given the broad strokes of this training program, but like, it's so important that you mentioned that you didn't always get it right at first, and you've had to iterate. What does it look like now? Like, what do you think is extraordinary or world class about the way that you train and develop people currently at Dartmouth Partners?
I think the aspiration is for it to be world class. I think we probably do a lot of things really well, and part of it is because, again, who are the heroes in the business? L&D for me is, you know, one of the areas that you want to herald and say they're super important. It's not a back office function. It's not a function that you utilize when you're struggling. You know, everything is blended around making our people better. And so I think the things that we do well, again, you know, hopefully role modeling what excellence looks like within that function. And you need people who are starters and finishers in that area. And you know, a lot of L&D people fall into, you know, unfortunately, one of those camps as well. So you need people can see it through. They need to know that they're taken seriously as well. You know, so again, L&D is one of the selling points of this business for people joining it and the support that you'll get. I think the things that we got wrong at the start, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right? So I'm a self-taught recruiter that found it intuitive because I grew up in a household where, you know, you're you're kind of born to hustle. So yeah, it's ingrained in you. So the kind of trap that I fell into with other people, so just follow me around and copy what I do, right? That's how the magic happens. it's probably the world's worst way of training someone. Right? So,
I think there's a place for shadowing and listening into calls and so on. That's definitely got to be part of it, but absolutely. Not the
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think generally the way we learn is by witnessing good role modeling, right? Yeah. So
right.
I spend a lot of my time looking for, different various parts of my life. I want to be a better family person who looks like they're a good father and husband, and I want to be a better Christian, find older Christians that have walked the walk. You want to find good business people, surround yourself with good business people, same with managers or billers. And so, we've got to role model that throughout our entire business, and yes. L&D's got to help support you and help you understand as well as do along the way.
Okay. You said something interesting earlier, which is that you don't want to micromanage people, and I 100% agree. At the same time, in order to have a scalable business, you need to have visibility of performance and metrics and understand what people need extra help with and what they're, where they're overachieving and so on. How do you organize that within Dartmouth Partners?
So we do keep KPIs, and I get the KPIs sent to me once a week, and I have a look at the key metric I look at really is jobs on, client meetings had and CVs out the door as a business, once a week. And actually we only started collecting that data properly during lockdown, because in a remote working environment, we need to see what was going on. I go back to, if you hire good people and give them freedom and responsibility in equal measure, they should embrace it. And if you've got the right person in the business, they'll embrace both with equal measure. The challenge, where you want to use the KPIs is, again, educating along the way and helping people understand. And that's part of the L&D function of how do I build my desk? Why am I spiking once a month or every quarter? Mm-hmm. As you build a team, helping them understand the KPIs. But I think it's quite a 1980s way of running recruitment firms. And I'm sure businesses bigger than us and more successful than us still do it in this way. And it works for them. But if you just do enough of activity, some nectar drops out through the end. I think you want to try and educate your workforce to understand what good activity looks like and what's the right activity for your market and for your area. And it does differ. And so I don't want to manage through KPIs. I just want the KPIs to act as one part of educating an individual along the way.
Makes sense. I actually think KPIs are incredibly important as a self-evaluation and decision-making tool. So regardless of whether the business is like enforcing certain KPIs or minimum expectations, I want to know what my ratios are, for example, like what percentage of jobs am I filling? What percentage of first interviews are leading to a second interview? And, if there's, because I want to work smarter rather than just work harder, right? So by measuring, you can very accurately assess, where you need to maybe perhaps give some extra focus in order to improve an issue, what have you.
I completely agree with that. I mean, most people who go to the gym, every day or consistently have a plan. Otherwise, you're gonna plateau, right? So you'll generally either keep a mental record or keep a physical log of what am I doing in the gym? What am I here for? Depending on what you're trying to achieve, you'll get quite granular on that with your diet, et cetera. So
exactly.
You definitely do it in one part of life. You can't expect to be successful in any industry actually by not keeping a record of what am I doing? How am I improving? And so I think the KPIs play a reasonably important part in that. I guess there's a difference between utilizing them to help people understand how to self-manage versus, imposing that on people.
I totally agree. I actually, it's interesting you're focused on jobs, meetings, and CVs. out. I prefer looking at first interviews as a metric rather than CVs out, because I feel like CVs submitted can, if you, now I understand you're not putting a target and saying you need to increase that, right? So that's different, but it can potentially get people focused on the wrong thing. Whereas the first interviews are a really good indicator of pipeline, more so than how many CVs did someone send. And there's a lot of poor practice in recruiting of just firing CVs out the door that are not, you know, the right ones for the client or what have you.
Yeah, I guess going back to the culture of our business, we're generally very in tune with our clients, and so actually, mm-hmm. you know, we're a low CVs out the door business, and the hit rate's very, very good. So I don't really need to, right. you know, personally, I don't look at the conversion because I know the conversion's high. What I want to check is, do people have enough roles on to send the right number of CVs out? But again, I actually don't go into that granular of detail, because the rhythm of the business, I'm sure the directors and the line managers and the team leaders should be looking at that stuff. But from a macro point of view, I let those guys run their teams, and if they've got individual problems, the MDs can pick up on it, or should be picking up on it. But the, you know, our conversion is generally pretty good.
What you said, you bounced around, Logan, between 20 and 30 people before you sort of broke through to that next level. What do you think was constraining your growth there? And then what did you do to change that?
Me?
Okay. Can you elaborate on that?
I mean, I've got to take responsibility ultimately for what was a failure in the business. Don't know what you don't know. You know, scratching your head, trying to work it out. What's going on? Why am I getting it wrong? I'd say that, you know, we probably at the, you know, 20 person mark, what did we exalt and herald? We heralded our top billers. You know, what do you get rewarded? You get rewarded for billing big. And we didn't, as I said, we didn't have a lot of good managers in the business, and I wasn't one of them. So, that was a failing in the business. We'd also probably fallen into the trap of a lot of startup recruitment companies saying, we're not a sales environment. You know, so we hired a lot of people that executed the work that I brought in or a couple others brought in. And then that transition phase, when we were getting to 30 people, where 2, 3, 4 people couldn't bring enough work in to feed 30. So we had to transition, where a lot of people voted with their feet, sadly, but saying, actually, we need you guys to go and sell. I was like, oof, I didn't sign up for that. Where is it? You know, where on the job spec does it say salesperson? and so that was a failing in our hiring policy, and we changed that in terms of being much more overt. And this is, you know, it's a sales job, and so we started hiring a slightly different type of person, and then training them in that. But look, ultimately, you know, I would say I fell into the trap of, you know, in some instances, hiring the wrong people, culturally letting, in one instance, a big biller get away with bad actions on the floor because they were a big biller. And that was me not being tough enough and strong enough in terms of my own beliefs of how to do things right. And I put my hand up for that's on me. And thirdly, we were still a very young business. So I guess at that point it was me, and then, you know, reasonably flat. And the journey of the business has been growing people to have a much better management structure and infrastructure around that.
Makes sense. So one of the keys was crystallizing and implementing an internal hiring strategy that was more effective, hiring the right people. But then secondly, really focusing on developing those people and, you know, building your future management team in a sense. Okay, that makes sense. And then you said after 50, it just has exploded. So what was the shift there that allowed you to really take the, you know, the stabilizers off and take off?
Start to pedal faster. So, at 40 to 50, you know, we had the infrastructure built. And, you know, bear in mind, we're constantly trying to build out the infrastructure to support the growth. Yeah. But I guess the investment from our PE backer changed things significantly in June 2018. Mm. That gave us a lot of confidence, I think, as a management team to think we're on the right track, getting institutional investment. The thing that they've done the most is broaden out our horizons as to what's possible. You know, they think that much bigger than we could possibly think. And unshackling. And I remember talking to, when we were thinking about an office move, and we weren't sure about Brexit and, you know, what does the future hold? And, you know, one of the investors said, look, just always plan for growth, plan for growth. And you know, I still worry about things going wrong. So I still have an eye on what could go wrong. But if you plan for growth, everyone's aligned to that. You know, and so the view now is that, and I think everyone's pushing for, how do I get the next job? You know, how do I develop myself? Mm-hmm. So it just pushes everyone up through the chain. And we've got a few people that have completely shot the lights out and are going really fast. And that's great. Wow. Because again, everyone looks at those people and says, well, I want to be like that. And they don't become exceptions. That, you know, you've got a few examples rather than just always having one person that's groundbreaking the whole time. So
absolutely,
that's where we've flown. We've supplemented that with some really good senior hires along the way who've come from being on the journey of bigger businesses, and they've helped give us more confidence because they'll say things like, you know, this business is in better shape than X was when we were on that journey, and we went from being a, you know, 2 million EBIT business to a 50 million EBIT business in 10 years. And this is going faster and is fundamentally a better business. Everyone listens and goes, okay, well, if they've done it and they're here again for the journey, it just imbues you with confidence. Doesn't take away the fact that it's graft, but it gives everyone, I guess, a bigger horizon and the confidence to go and chase it.
Amazing. So I've read on LinkedIn that it was 2018. You received $5.5 million in investment. Is that accurate?
It was 2018. I think it was slightly more than that, but it was a mixture of debt and equity.
Okay. And now sometimes taking PE investment can have a detrimental effect on the culture. If the investors are not aligned with what, you know, you are about and what you're trying to achieve, and maybe the focus can shift towards ROI rather than long-term sustainability. What's been your experience of that?
My personal experience is that we got into bed with the right people. They've been really supportive. Yeah. I'm actually really thankful for all the help they've given us. As I said, they've been great people to work with, and you know, I would say that the literacy team have been great. Actually, as I said, they've opened up to our horizons. You still have to do the work. They're definitely not micromanagers, and the debate has generally always been pretty good natured. Choosing a PE firm, and I don't think that's been the experience for everyone, as you've just said. I think choosing the right PE firm is super important, depending on where you are and the stage of the journey. So, you know, for me, I didn't want to hop off the bus, and a lot of people want to cash out and walk out the door because they don't want the rigors that go with that. I go back to the starting point of, you know, why Dartmouth. I wanted to grow personally. I wanted this to be a vehicle to have that journey with others. And so, yes, you know, we've kept, you know, more or less all our senior team and added to it over the last 2.5 years. You know, next iteration, I hope that, you know, it's still just another stepping stone onto something bigger.
Amazing. And then you had this acquisition. When did that happen?
So we closed that September 2019, which in retrospect was fortuitous timing for the vendors.
Absolutely. So, but what, why acquisition? Like, why not just focus on organic growth, continuing to grow the Dartmouth Partners brand?
So we've probably got three things underpinning what we plan to do. So we've got a group brand that actually gets announced this week, which is Topco, and that will hold sub market facing brands. So think of WPP or S4 Capital as it is today, we will have core organic growth within Dartmouth that is, you know, close to market leading. We've grown 30% top and bottom line every year. We'll use that to organically grow new business areas and potentially spin them out. So things like HR, we're pretty open saying we'll get that to 20, 30 people and spin that out as a separate brand, because that cascades through the sub brands really well.
Of course.
And then we'll acquire where we want to go into markets that we're, you know, we think we're better off buying a foothold in that market and then building around it. And pure within tax, infrastructure, governance, compliance it's a great business, you know, been around for 20 years, and specifically within tax, it's really, really well known. It's not all that they do, but it's really well known. And so, you know, we felt that it's a business that was pretty well run, that we could help go faster. And again, just, you know, at circa 80 people, it was a business that we could inject some pace into to just slowly improve it operationally.
Love it. Logan, I talk to a lot of recruitment entrepreneurs, and you think big. I love like how just your vision just seems like so far beyond the typical owner. It's really exciting. What about the US?
We've got, so through Pure, we've got about 20 people in New York.
Okay.
We've got a lady called Daisy who was meant to be out for Dartmouth March last year. She was out in New York as the world went into lockdown. So she got on the last plane back and came back to London, got back into a flat, and has been working remotely for a year. She's got her flights booked for June this year. So she'll be on the ground. And we've just hired as group head of international, so working for that top brand Colonel, a chap called James Wakefield, who was previously the CEO of Cobalt. And he led a lot of their international builds. So he's going to help us specifically with getting kind of international, not just in America, but globally, to hopefully be half the business in the next 3 years.
Amazing. Well, Logan, I feel like we've scratched the surface here, but I'd love to do this again sometime, but it's been really, really interesting. And thank you so much for coming on the Resilient Recruiter.
No, not at all. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for listening. Just before you go, let me ask you one question. Who in your network would make a great guest on the Resilient Recruiter podcast? I'm always on the lookout for interesting people to interview. Recruitment entrepreneurs who embody the ethos of the Resilient Recruiter. If you're a regular listener, you'll know the kind of person I'm looking for. Ordinary men and women who've achieved extraordinary things. Specifically, I'm looking for someone with a great story to tell, someone who's overcome adversity in pursuit of their goals, and who's open to sharing their own mistakes and learning experiences with our listeners. In the words of previous guests John Coxon and Alex Elliott, I'm looking for someone with humble confidence. They could be a top-producing solo or independent recruiter, or the owner of a fast-growing firm. Maybe that person is you. Or maybe it's someone you know. Send me your recommendations, mark@recruitmentcoach.com, or feel free to nominate yourself. And if you think you meet the criteria I've just outlined, I'd love to hear from you. Once again, it's mark@recruitmentcoach.com. Remember to hit subscribe, and I'll see you next time.